Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today our special guest is Dr. Martin Baudry.
I think I know the guy.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny coincidence that.
Yeah.
Sounds strangely familiar.
Martin is a philosopher and doctoral researcher at Ghent University in Belgium, where his research concentrates on philosophy of pseudoscience, evolutionary theory, epistemology, irrationality, and skepticism. Martin, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Martin just recently co-edited a book called The Philosophy of Pseudoscience, Reconsidering the Demarcation Problem.
I think I know the book.
Who's the co-author? Wait, let me think. Hold on.
Now it suddenly hits me. Yeah, that's how we got to know each other, right?
It's this guy, Massimo Pigliucci, was the co-author. Yeah. What a coincidence. We have him right here. Yeah.
Actually, co-editor, because the book is actually a collection of
co-editor. Co-editor.
Yeah, the book just fell off my shelf. It was really spooky to see it happen.
So
it's actually just, I haven't seen the book yet, so this is a... to bring it up now, I don't know, Massimo, have you seen the book already?
Because I've seen the book. It's beautiful.
It downloaded
automatically on my Kindle a couple of days ago. Yeah.
All right. Right. Is the Kindle edition already published?
It is. Yes. It's available on Amazon. We'll link to it on the podcast website. But so, Martin, would you be willing to just summarize what the issue that the contributors to your book are talking about is about? What is the philosophy of pseudoscience and the demarcation problem?
Well, there are not a lot of philosophers of pseudoscience around, actually. I mean, Massimo and I did a count recently, and we seem to be... Well, we started out as the only ones on the planet, probably.
There's an advantage at creating one own field, you know. It's like you're
the best in the field.
Exactly, automatically.
Yeah, and I'm the runner-up. I'm the second best, so I can live with that. We have one of our main interests is what we call the philosophy of pseudoscience, and we have compiled this volume where we have solicited chapters from philosophers, sociologists, psychologists, people who are interested in pseudoscience and in what philosophers call the demarcation problem, and that is the dividing line between science on the one hand and pseudoscience on the other hand. So this is really a multidisciplinary book that brings together researchers from different fields to think about this question about what is science, what constitutes good science, and how can you distinguish science from pseudoscience. This isn't a project that has been out of fashion, you know, to the extent that philosophy is trafficking in fashions. Yeah, I think it does in a certain way. It has been out of fashion for decades because most philosophers, if you ask them, and the ones that are not aware of this book, would say that the demarcation problem has been put to rest decades ago. And a name that often comes up in this regard is Larry Lawden. He's a philosopher of science, and he claimed to have demonstrated or shown that we should really not only abandon this whole idea of demarcationism, so finding the difference between science and pseudoscience, but we should also get rid of the very term pseudoscience. You know, he thinks that it's derogatory, it's negative, and it suggests a naive conception of what is science about. And of course, we disagree. We think.
Right.
Sorry,
what's wrong with that?
I don't want to bang out about Lawden because I'll just put this up because it's a standard reference in the field, and it's like a locus classicus, something that many papers on pseudoscience begin with as a reference. So the idea is that we actually want to resuscitate, or we want to bring this demarcation project back to life, and we want to show that Lawton's obituary of the demarcation problem, you know, was a bit too quick, a bit too premature.
Yeah,
and we think,
like,
that we have a lot of people that agree with us, and they have contributed to this volume. So we're all in the same boat, so to speak.
Yeah, although we'll get into a little later on, I think, in some of the controversies and even disagreements among several authors of contributors to the book. It's not like just we agree that there is such a thing as a demarcation problem, we all agree about how to answer it or deal with it. But
correctly.
Before we go on, I think following up on what Martin just said, it was an interesting experience for Martin and for myself to put together the proposal for this book, because we were, of course, very aware of Loudon's classic paper and of its effect, long-lasting effect. This is one of the most influential papers in this area. And so when we started thinking about, well, maybe it's be time to sort of resuscitate this issue and think about it. After all, the demarcation problem has a very long history in philosophy of science. At the very least, it started out with Karl Popper, who actually coined the term demarcation to begin with. So we're talking early 20th century, and actually, arguably, you can find traces of it further back. So when we put together the proposal, two interesting things happened from my perspective as sort of the co-editor of the book. The first one was that we asked a bunch of people if they wanted to contribute. And, you know, I've done edited books before, and typically the rate of positive responses is anywhere between, 50 and 70% or something like that. Because you pick authors, of course, that you know are likely to want to contribute, but then people have stuff to do or maybe have other priorities or whatever, and, so you have a certain amount of lower amount of response than you'd like. In this case, essentially 100% of the people we contacted answered positively and enthusiastically, which that was a little bit surprising. And then Chicago Press, which is the publisher for the book, sent out the proposal for peer review, because this is a book that it's going to be published. It's published by an academic press, so it goes out for peer review. And the reviewers unanimously said, "Yeah, it was about time that somebody brought up this thing." So apparently, we did hit on the right moment, historical moment. People were sort of getting apparently a little wary of these constant citation of Loudon 87 as the death knell for demarcation, and they wanted to say something about it. The other advantage, the other thing that is very nice about as an experience about editing a book, although it's as a process, it's usually a big pain, because you have to deal, of course, with authors who are late or they go beyond the limit of what they're supposed to be writing in terms of sort of length, and then with the reviewers, and then there's a lot of stuff going on. But one of the things that it's great about doing this sort of exercise is that it suddenly puts you 1 or 2 years ahead of everybody else in the field, because all of a sudden what the best people, the best practitioners in that particular area of investigation are actually thinking about and about to publish. And so this was a great learning experience as far as I'm concerned. It was a lot of fun. But
absolutely,
Martin, maybe we should get into some of the controversies. What are some of the stuff that struck you as disagreement among even the contributors to the book?
Yeah, can you imagine? We actually have something to discuss. Quite right for you to mention this. Is of course we still have. I mean, in general, I would say almost all of the people who have contributed to the book, they think that it's a worthy cause or worthy endeavor to think about these issues. So they don't dismiss the whole problem of science versus pseudoscience about demarcationism out of hand. But of course, merely agreeing on that doesn't mean that you agree on all the details. And as it happens, there are a lot of controversies that are still raging among those people who agree that we should, we should pay more interest to this distinction between science and pseudoscience. So this book is not the definitive statement on the issue, but I think you're right that we have contributions from the leading proponents, leading investigators of the field, and I hope that it will spark further debate and that will be a reference or a major reference for people who want to write about these issues from now on. So we want to talk about the controversies among the people.
Well, actually, just very briefly, let me just make sure I understand what demarcation consists of. Are you just looking for sort of features like does this field actually test predictions? Does this field, you know, change its mind over time? And you're looking for criteria like those that would allow us to, you know, to describe which fields are actually doing science and which aren't?
Yeah, that is. I mean, I think you described the part of the demarcation problem that is of most interest to me. So that's what we call the normative problem. That just means that you're interested in the good versus the bad, the good science, the genuine science versus the bad science, the pseudoscience. Pseudoscience is inherently a derogatory term. Nobody is proud to be a pseudoscientist. So,
right.
But I think there are other distinctions to be made with regard to science. For example, you can also ask, well, what is the boundary between science and philosophy, or between science and everyday reasoning? And traditionally, this has also been considered as part of the demarcation project. Actually, I think that one of the confusing things about the demarcation project is that it has it's like an umbrella term for different projects. I think that the normative problem, the one you just mentioned, you know, which theories are good in the sense that they make predictions, they are falsifiable, they are progressive, versus the ones that are bad, that don't have all these features. That is the most important problem that philosophers should be interested in and should be paying attention to. But I know, for example, because you were trying to get at these controversies, Massimo pays a lot more attention to the distinction between science, for example, on the one hand, and philosophy on the other hand. That is also a form of demarcationism, and that happens to be a domain where we, well, do we disagree there, Massimo? I don't want to. Shall we agree to disagree? Or
yeah,
I put it out very cautiously.
I don't know. Actually, that's a good question, because so my position about science and philosophy, and you know, listeners of the podcast and readers of the blog, I think know this pretty well at this point. But my position about the difference between science and philosophy is that they are distinct fields as practiced and in terms of what they aim at. And to me, this is evident simply by reading next to each other a random sample of science papers and a random sample of philosophy papers. They're clearly written very different. They're about different topics, and they work, you know, structurally very, very differently. That does not mean, of course, that there are no interesting interactions, you know, or borderline areas between science and philosophy. Clearly, for instance, philosophy of mind is better have interactions with neurobiology and, you know, neuroscience. Philosophy of science better have interactions with science as it is practiced. Philosophy of mathematics better have interactions with mathematics, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean that philosophy of science is reduced to a concept, you know, just studying science. It doesn't mean the philosophy of mathematics is mathematics, and mm-hmm. or that mathematicians can solve philosophical problems even in their own fields. That sort of, so that's what I see the differences between the two.
Right. Well, and in a way, I agree, and I can follow much of what you said. Maybe my main concern would be that if you take discussions in what is called philosophy of biology, philosophy of mind, then it's the philosophical parts of the research and the empirical parts, you know, the scientific parts, can be so intertwined that it's often difficult to pull them apart.
Yeah, I would agree.
And one of the things, with regard to the demarcation problem, I think that it is not so important, or let's say it is less important to distinguish science and philosophy in a field such as philosophy of biology, because both of them are working together on similar problems, similar projects, and it's often hard to tell from reading a paper whether the author was a philosopher or a biologist or a psychologist, so that this precise distinction between science and philosophy, I think, is not something that we should worry too much about. I mean, it's not something that carries much weight if you compare it to the difference between science and pseudoscience. That has a major impact on society. It can cause a lot of harm. There are a lot of things that hinge on this distinction, because it's a normative distinction. It's a distinction between the good versus the bad. Whereas if you want to pull apart the philosophical and the scientific elements in a field such as philosophy of biology, it's not that you want to distinguish the good from the bad, because
right.
Presumably both the philosophical and the scientific parts of that research are valuable.
You're just deciding what to call it.
Yeah, you're just deciding what to call it. And to some extent, you would say that this paper is more into the philosophical tradition. But I think if it's pure philosophy, completely a priori, it doesn't involve any empirical input, then I think it's pretty sterile. You know, it is, I think good philosophers, especially nowadays, as philosophy of mind, philosophy of biology, at least they should make use of the state of the art in the respective scientific fields. And
I agree.
That also applies the other way around. So scientists have to take into account the best philosophical arguments that have been made and that are relevant to their research. I think it was Daniel Dennett who once said that there's no such thing as philosophy-free science. There's only science that has taken on board its philosophical baggage, so to speak, without examination. So some scientists pretend, or they believe that they can do without philosophy, but they cannot. And some philosophers maybe think that they can do pure philosophy, and they don't have to. They're even it's part of their professional pride that they're just not interested in the empirical issues. I think that is sterile philosophy.
I agree. Actually, there's a joke.
So we do agree.
We do agree on that one. And there is a joke actually at the CUNY graduate centers, you know, where I teach, which is, if you want to put an end to a discussion after a departmental seminar, just say something on the lines of, well, but that's an empirical question. And that stops everybody.
So, Martin, as you mentioned, the distinction between science and pseudoscience at least has serious consequences for, you know, what we should be spending our time on, what we should be taking seriously, paying attention to, acting on the basis of. So I want to return to that question. And Massimo had asked you earlier to talk about controversies about the issue of demarcating science from pseudoscience in particular between the contributors of your book. Are there any that particularly stand out to you?
For example, one thing that is explicitly discussed in our book is the question whether or not science has any bearing on supernatural claims. So this some people, for example, they say that part of the solution to the demarcation problem is that science is restricted to the natural domain. Anything that falls outside of the natural domain can never be science. So that's part of the solution to the demarcation problem. Other people who have contributed to the book, they would argue that there's nothing wrong with supernatural claims per se. It's just that all the ones that have been put forward now haven't been substantiated, and there's not really, I mean, there isn't any good prospect that they will be substantiated in the future. So that is one thing. I mean, we can go on about this. I can give you another example, or it depends on what, I mean, what is most interesting for the listeners.
I'd be interested to hear if Massimo and you disagree about that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, Massimo, where do you fall between those two positions Martin outlined?
About the supernatural.
Yeah, and whether the problem with the supernatural is, you know, just that so far no claims have been, or no theories have been confirmed, or whether it's just sort of inherently, meaningless or nonsensical.
Well, first of all, the way I look at what science can say about the supernatural is the way I look at most of these demarcation problems, which is there isn't going to be a sharp line dividing things or saying, okay, here is exactly where science can get, and beyond that is exactly where it cannot get. It's going to be a continuum. It's going to be, you know, whenever we draw a line, there's going to be a line in the sand. What I'm interested in is more, you know, what kind of claims we can make, and what is the what philosophers call the epistemic warrant of that of those claims. That is, what do we base them on? So, specifically about supernatural, for instance, it's pretty clear to me that certain specific claims made by, let's call them supernaturalists, believers in the supernatural, are obviously within the confines of science. If a young Earth creationist says, you know, the Earth is 6,000 years old, that it's false on scientific grounds. It's an empirical claim, and it's false. End of story, as far as I'm concerned. So that's definitely within the purview of science. However, if somebody says a god of unspecified characteristics created the universe, and that's it, that's all it says, you know, so essentially a deist position, well, there, I don't really think that there's anything at all that is empirically actionable, and therefore there is anything at all that science can say about it. And then there is a bunch of stuff in between. And the stuff in between, I think it's where the usually where demarcation problems become interesting. So, for instance, what about a young Earth creationist who says, well, yes, I made a specific claim about the Earth being 6,000 years old, and you think it's been debunked by science, but in fact, this is a God testing our faith because, you know, he really created the universe from scratch 6,000 years ago, but just made it look like, you know, it was billions of years old to test our faith. And by the way, I'm not making this up. Some creationists actually do take that position.
It actually happens.
Right, it actually happens. it seems to me that that is an interesting move, because that move is sort of analogous the appearance of an empirical contradiction between the claim of the supernaturalists and the way things are. But it immediately explains, and I'm using the word explaining here in a very loose and generous sense, that contradiction by saying, yeah, but, you know, I have an explanation for this. This is what happened. God thinks this way and that way. Of course, you could ask the guy, how do you know that God thinks this way or that way? But that's a different question. So what that does to me is it points out that the basic idea that supernatural positions, what, you know, Dawkins famously called the God hypothesis, are too amorphous, they are too flexible, they are too sometimes even incoherent to really qualify as anything close to a scientific hypothesis. So when I say that science cannot, you know, reject certain supernatural positions or doesn't have anything to say about supernatural positions, I don't mean to imply that that's the limit of science. I think that's because of the incoherence or incredible degree of flexibility of the supernaturalist's position. Now, often one of the answers to sort of the rebuttals on the other side of this debate is, but what about claims that of the paranormal, for instance? Right? So are paranormal claim also supernatural? You know, so does that imply also that science there also cannot say anything? Or are they, as most skeptics would agree, within the purview of science? And that's why we talk about scientific skepticism. And I said that the answer there is also, well, it depends. Let's talk about, I don't know, dowsing, which I've actually tested in the field, several years ago, in a particular instance. Well, if you're talking about the actual empirical claims of a dowser, you know, I can find water with much more accuracy than randomness just by holding up a stick
mostly wood.
Wood, yeah. Usually it's wood. Then it's like, well, we can test that. Sure enough, we did test that, and right. No, it wasn't able to do that sort of stuff. Now, the paranormal claim then changes to, well, the reason you cannot do that, the test fails, is because the paranormal power is inversely proportional to the presence of skeptics, which, again, mm-hmm. I'm not making up. There's people actually say that sort of stuff. Now you're sort of going into something that begins to smell a lot like supernatural to me and not just paranormal. I mean, the basic idea of paranormal, or let's say UFOs, is that these are natural phenomena that are simply unknown to science now. But
and by natural phenomena, you mean phenomena?
No. By natural phenomena, I mean not miracles, right?
Phenomena that are natural, right?
That's right. Not breaking the laws of nature, right? So a UFO, a flying saucer that is actually a machine made by intelligent beings that travels the universe and comes here, that's a natural phenomenon that is obviously within the confines of science.
Right.
But if you think of UFOs, you know, as angels, as you know, preternatural beings that come in from a different mystical dimension, well, now we're talking about something completely different.
And what's the difference between something that's supernatural and something that is just beyond what we previously thought of as natural, but, you know, then gets, like, folded into our understanding of what's natural?
Well, that's a good question, and it's also a question that changes, the answers to which changes over time, clearly, right? So we have instances from the history of science and even from the history of pseudoscience. I mean, there were people thinking that there were things like witches, for instance, clearly a supernatural thing. And then we figure out, no, actually, these are people who are mentally distressed, I mean, for one reason or another. We brought it back into the natural. So clearly there are examples like that. But certainly it is conceivable. I don't think there is any example or there will ever be an example, but it's certainly conceivable that there are actual supernatural phenomena, meaning there actually is a god or gods who can at will change or suspend the laws of nature. And those are the ones that I think one can say very little about because they violate one of the fundamental assumptions of science, which is the continuity of nature. I didn't invent this. This goes back to David Hume. So that's what I'm saying. I don't think there is any actual case of that sort, just like Hume didn't think there was any actual case of miracles. But it certainly is conceivable, and therefore it does make sense to say, well, if something like that actually did happen, what would we be able to say about it? And my answer, I think, is not much.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about these discussions about demarcationism is that if you ask a philosopher or a scientist to evaluate a specific case, for example, creationism, parapsychology, ufology, then they will mostly agree where that specific instance belongs. So is it a case of science? Is it a case of pseudoscience? And that suggests that we're making use of the same criteria. But they're not explicit. So if then you go to the next step, well, the thing that the philosopher is interested in, you ask, well, but it, exactly in virtue of what is something a pseudoscience and why doesn't it deserve to be called a science? Then you see that the diagnosis will differ. Well, with respect to parapsychology, for example, I agree with Massimo. I mean, the thing that he said about the cop outs that they often use when an experiment fails. As the strength of this force is inversely proportional to the presence of inquisitive observers. That is obviously there's something fishy about this. I mean, we all feel that you know this will not do. But then, as a philosopher, you have to get clear about but where exactly does it go wrong? I mean, what exactly is the problem with this strategy? And for me, terms such as supernatural or the paranormal are so fuzzy and vague and elusive, and I agree with Massimo on that account. So that, I mean, this what can we do with those terms? They're so incoherent. But precisely because they're so incoherent, I don't think it's a good idea to refer to them as part of a solution to the demarcation problem, precisely because I mean they're so unstable that we shouldn't direct any kind of philosophical argument on its shoulders. So what I'm interested in is that let's delve a little deeper, and instead of focusing on these terms supernatural, paranormal, what is the underlying problem with these moves? And I would say the more general problem is that they're ad hoc. They're ad hoc in the sense of that the sole reason why people use them is because they want to protect their theory against an apparent falsification, and it's a very convenient way to do so.
I agree, although it seems like it would be hard to to define when someone's being ad hoc and when they're not? Like,
that's a good question.
Why legitimate tests could fail legitimately.
You can do that ad hoc. Case by case.
I could just, off the top of my head, I can come up with a definition that suits my purposes, and it would be ad hoc on a meta level, but let's just drop that for a second. So the idea is, I agree that, I agree on the phenomena, let's say, or the moves in parapsychology or in creationism that raise our suspicions and say, hey, wait a minute, this is very, what is happening here is very strange. But if you think about this this issue in terms of the difference between natural and supernatural, I don't think that clarifies a lot. I mean, for one thing, because even in a perfectly natural context, for example, in a conspiracy theory, you also have these so-called ad hoc moves. I prefer the term immunizing strategies because they're ways of immunizing, protecting the theory against refutation. So let's take some sort of matrix-like scenario where the whole world is, it's some sort of computer simulation. So we live in a kind of global conspiracy.
Well, that's true, right?
That is right. I was taking a realistic example just to get into philosophical thought experiments. So let's take the Matrix, because we all know that we live in the Matrix, right? So
exactly.
Even in that context, presumably, it's a science fiction movie, so it's most people wouldn't call the Matrix hypothesis supernatural, but it doesn't really matter for me because. Intrinsically, it's the same idea. It's you have a theory that is completely impervious to any kind of refutation, because you have find out you have discovered some way of making it completely immune to any kind of empirical problem, to any kind of refutation. So whether or not you want to call this supernatural doesn't really matter to me, especially in light of the fact that, well, what we consider natural and supernatural has changed over time. I can give you a ballpark definition, like a definition of supernatural that captures some of the stuff that we usually call supernatural. I could say, for example, well, if something has a mental, it's intrinsically mental, so it cannot be reduced to inanimate matter. It's not physics. If something is it's outside of the universe, transcends the universe that we know, then we might want to call it supernatural. And so some people might agree on that. And I mean, it would be a good definition, for example, to think about traditional miracle stories in religions. But I don't think that a lot depends on that definition. So it's not something. I think it's something that philosophers should stay clear of, because it doesn't really help, because the term is so slippery. And for example, with respect to parapsychology, one thing I think that I disagree on with Massimo is that Massimo said that for parapsychologists, the idea of psychic force is a natural hypothesis. They think that, you know, it's some sort of particle that we haven't discovered yet, and that for some reason we, you know, that is not integrated in our current understanding of physics. And I agree that there is a strand in parapsychology that goes along these lines. You know, they think that finally physicists will discover what is the underlying mechanism of psychic forces, and it will be integrated in the framework of physics. But there are other strands in psychology that go into a different direction, and that take it to be some sort of mystical force, something spiritual, something almost supernatural. And then, of course, right, for most parapsychologists, it's not clear at all. So they make stuff up. They remain ambiguous about this, because it allows them, you know, just to go on about their business and to keep the very notion of psychic forces slippery. Now, if we want to say that parapsychology is a pseudoscience, and I think Massimo and I both agree on that, I mean, it is a pseudoscience for the reason that Massimo mentioned, then I say, well, it doesn't really matter. We don't have to decide first, is it supernatural, is it paranormal or not, because the real issues, the things that really matter for philosophical purposes, for what we call epistemic purposes, the things that are related to knowledge, go deeper than those labels that we attach to them, such as supernatural and paranormal. So that's why I think that in a way, the very term supernatural in the context of demarcation problem is a red herring, because it doesn't really solve anything.
So this is getting into my confusion about the demarcation problem. There are some parapsychological studies, like most famously or notoriously the Daryl Bem study, which claimed to show evidence of precognition, statistically significant evidence of precognition, and was published in a top psychology journal. And the critiques of that, there were, you know, many legitimate critiques of that study, but they were about the methodology, and they were things like, well, you know, the hypotheses were sort of like cherry-picked or like switched around on the fly during the experiments. The effect sizes declined as the sample size got larger, which is sort of a sign of data mining. And these are all like good reasons to dismiss the study.
Yeah, not to mention that attempts at repeating the study failed.
That's true. That's true. But the problem I'm having is that you could apply those same criticisms to many, many studies in psychology or other sciences, especially other, you know, softer sciences. It's often the case that people data mine. It's often the case that people sort of, you know, change their hypothesis as they're getting data. Right. It's often the case that studies don't replicate, but we don't call all of psychology a pseudoscience.
Right,
so is it just about the fact, the sort of topic that Daryl Bem was studying, and the fact that we should have very small priors on...
In part, I think it is. I'm curious to see what Martin has to say about this. But my immediate response to the BEM study, to that kind of question about the BEM study, is twofold. First of all, you're right. There are a lot of studies, although I don't know the actual number nor frequency, honestly, but there's a number of studies published in the psychological literature, social science literature, and frankly, even in medical research literature, that do have very low standards, and they failed for the same reasons. And okay, so just by the bullet, those are just as bad studies, and we should just reject them on at least on that ground. But I think your second question is more interesting, which is why... It seems like we're sort of setting up, some people, including me, are setting up a sort of double standard when it comes to claims of the paranormal. And I think that's correct. It's not a double standard, it's a higher standard. And it really goes back to David Hume once more, or if you prefer, to Carl Sagan's popularization of Hume's famous dictum, which is, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. You know, if you're doing a run-of-the-mill, boring average study in, you know, ecology, psychology, social science, whatever, and you come up with conclusions that are just as boring and predictable and very much inconsequential, you know, frankly, I don't even care if the study isn't done particularly well. It's not going to make much of a difference. But if you're claiming the discovery of a major, entirely new natural phenomenon that could potentially overturn everything we know about biology, physics, and chemistry, I'm sorry, I'm going to raise the standard. And so I think that's fair.
Oh, it seems clearly fair, and that seems like clearly it's bad science if the evidence you're giving is not, you know, anywhere near as strong as it should be to overcome very low priors on that, you know, the phenomenon you're claiming or hypothesizing is the case. But does that make it bad science, or why does that make it pseudoscience?
I think Martin
it
has
seems
an interesting.
There could be many fields,
yeah, I think
where
Martin has an interesting take on this.
I hope so. I don't know. Let's say, I think what makes it pseudoscience is not so much the fact that it's sloppy research, because as you say, there's probably a lot of sloppy research in psychology. The fact that makes it pseudoscience is that people like Daryl Bem and other parapsychologists have doubted this research and other experiments as if it was a conclusive demonstration of psychic phenomena. So if you want to talk about a pseudoscience, then you need to have a particular doctrine. It's a doctrine, it's a theory that pretends to be science, but it isn't. Why do we know that it isn't? Because in spite of all the attempts to find solid evidence for that theory, all those attempts have failed. So if parapsychology was a new research program, as it was, for example, at the beginning of the century, then I think we should at least, I think that's also what happened, we should give it more credit, because it was still an open question whether or not there was something like psychic phenomena. But we're not in the early days of parapsychological research anymore. What we see is that we see a recurring pattern. I mean, there's every once in a while, after not every decade, but let's say every year, there is an experiment that allegedly finally demonstrates psychic phenomena. And then you see, if you get a closer look at the methodology, if you try to replicate the experiment, all those attempts have failed. So the results that parapsychologists have been have come up with have not withstood scrutiny. If you then take yet another of these studies, such as the one that Daryl Bem has conducted, which was really particularly outrageous even to parapsychological standards, because it involved backward causation, which is something that's so weird. That, I mean, it's not just psychic phenomena, it's things that are traveling back in time. This is such a weird claim. And if you say that that gives you a final or demonstration or it proves that psychic phenomena do exist, then I think that you're being, basically stubborn. because after all those failed attempts, it's really, really premature to consider this as conclusive proof of parapsychology. So you're right that there is a lot of sloppy research in psychology, but if you're dealing with a pseudoscience, then you need, I think, a more or less well-defined doctrine that people maintain and that the advocates maintain and they claim it to be scientific. So they think, you know, this theory, we really have a lot of evidence on our side, and this is what parapsychologists believe. They it's not just Daryl Bem. I mean, they if you discuss these issues with them, they're gonna come up with a huge list of so-called demonstrations of the paranormal. So they pretend that it's science, but it isn't, because all those studies, for various reasons, have been debunked or have been invalidated. If you continue to pretend that you have a solid case, then I think you're a pseudoscientist, because the word pseudoscientist means false, pretending something that is claimed to be scientific, but is not really scientific by any reasonable standard.
And there's,
I think that's what makes it pseudoscience.
Yeah, I think that what Martin is getting at is actually one of the things that emerged from the book, The Philosophy of Pseudoscience, very clearly, and which was kind of interesting to see, because when I asked that, when the two of us asked several contributors to send us their chapters, and we agreed on, you know, general topics and all that, you never know what people are actually going to write. And, you know, we sent, obviously, the chapters for peer review and all that. But what was interesting to see was that in several areas, there was quite a bit of convergence about the thinking of different people for a specific problem. And one of these areas of convergence was basically what Martin was getting at, which is that contrary to the classical way of looking at demarcation problem, the demarcation problem has always been sort of considered, implicitly at least, as a static issue. You know, something is either science or pseudoscience, it's not going to change.
Right.
Many of our contributors have actually suggested this idea that Martin was getting at, which is actually, no, this is that demarcation area, and it's not really a line, it's a demarcation sort of border, actually changes over time. And we have very interesting examples even within the recent history of science. The most obvious one in my mind is cold fusion. Mm-hmm. Cold fusion started out as pretty much science, surprising science, you know, novel science, if it had, you know, turned out to be true. But science nonetheless. This was done by legitimate scientists at a legitimate university, was published in a legitimate peer-reviewed journal, and there were legitimate attempts at replicating the phenomenon. So it started out as science. But, of course, quickly became clear that the phenomenon could not be repeated. There were issues with the basic theory of it, and clearly with the empirical evidence. And so very quickly, you know, within, I think, a matter of months or a year at most, the relevant scientific community, that is the community of physicists and chemists, had pretty much agreed that, no, there's no such thing as cold fusion. It's just not going to work. But that hasn't stopped some of these, vocal minority of people from insisting up to this point that Cold Fusion is real. They now have started having their own conferences, their own journal where they publish their so-called results, and they insist, you know, that, and they have begun acquiring traits typical of pseudoscience. That is, they think that there is a conspiracy among the standard academic environment to suppress the truth and blah 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 and all that. So they moved very quickly. This is a real-time example that has happened over the last few years. They moved very quickly from science to pseudoscience, precisely along the lines that Martin was discussing before. So it is a temporal issue here that it's important to keep in mind.
Martin,
yeah, I completely agree. So something, I mean, it goes the other way around, of course. I mean, something that is now considered pseudoscience can, in principle,
sure,
develop into science later on. I mean, if suppose that we the attempt to replicate Ben's research had really been borne out, then it would have attracted even more attention by other researchers. And at some point, I think there is no reason why why the gates should remain closed forever and ever. I mean, I wouldn't bet any money on it because
no.
precisely for the reason I mentioned, because there have been so many failed attempts that it's really very unlikely that suddenly we're gonna realize that we have overlooked some evidence that has been staring at us for decades and we just didn't notice. I mean, it's not because of lack of attempts that people haven't found evidence for psychic phenomena, but that's just a contingent matter. I mean, in principle, I think that we could have scientific evidence for psychic forces, and as Massimo said, something. A theory like phrenology at some point was taught at major European universities and was at least a promising research program, but after a while it encountered so many empirical and conceptual problems that to most reasonable people it was dead, and if people had abandoned it, then that would be it. It would just have been a failed hypothesis. It only degenerates into a pseudoscience when after a while it is clear to most reasonable people that this research avenue is closed, that people continue to pursue it, not only pursue it, but they're going to insist that they actually have found good scientific evidence, and then mostly the next step is indeed, as Massimo said, to invoke some sort of conspiracy by the scientific establishment to explain why the theory hasn't been accepted yet. That's the point where it devolves into pseudoscience. But as you say, pseudoscience and both science and pseudoscience are historical notions. They are not written in stone for all eternity.
Martin, we're just about out of time, but before we wrap up, I wanted to make sure to ask you about. So I'm a big fan of what's many of our listeners might know of as the Sokol hoax, in which Alan Sokol submitted a sham paper to a postmodernist journal that sort of sounded vaguely profound and sophisticated and used lots of physics and math jargon in completely meaningless ways, and the paper was accepted, and it was sort of a notorious expose of the low epistemological standards of postmodernist disciplines. And as it turns out, as I have learned, you have perpetrated your own so-called style hoax on a theology journal. You want to tell us a little bit about your paper titled The Paradoxes of Darwinian Disorder Towards an Ontological Reaffirmation of Order and Transcendence?
Right.
The title is poetry. Poetry, Martin.
Oh, thank you. It was my humble attempt at a hoax, and to my own surprise, it was immediately accepted at two theology conferences, which was 100% success rate because those were the only conferences that I submitted it to. For me it was an exercise in grammatically correct, you know, pseudo profundities and word salads, gibberish,
whatever you want to call it. As long as they are grammatically correct.
They were. Oh, yeah. I hope so. My English is not perfect, but it has not been proofread by a native speaker. It was not worth it, basically. But the way I wrote it, actually, was I wrote it backwards because I wanted to make sure that there were no meaningful connections between the sentences. So as soon as it started to make sense, I dropped the sentence or I started from scratch again. Because literally, if you read every single sentence, it's just completely meaningless. But if you read it superficially, it suggests all kinds of, meaningful connections and reverberations.
But it sort of does.
You start to think of that.
I'm skimming through a paragraph or two now, and I can, feel the sort of vague meaning shimmering just on the edge of my comprehension.
Right. That's interesting because that's the way our brains work.
Exactly.
You read it and you connect some dots and you think, hey, that's actually, yeah. And you see the dialectic and this opposed to that and then, but not in as much as this. But it's completely meaningless. This is actually an interesting example because for me, it's an example of what I would call pseudo-philosophy. This goes back to the issue that we discussed right in the beginning of this podcast. I think that the distinction between philosophy and science as such is not that important. And one of the reasons why I think so is that in a way, there's a similar distinction within philosophy between, let's say good philosophy on the one hand and pseudo-philosophy on the one hand, which is very similar to the more traditional demarcation problem between science on the one hand and pseudoscience on the other hand. So
I agree.
There are a lot of commonalities between strategies that are used by pseudoscientists, ambiguity, for example, equivocation, the stuff that we discussed in with regard to do the supernatural. On the other hand, bad philosophy. The reason why it's so difficult to attack the abstract that I wrote for this theology conference is that it's precisely because it's so slippery. It doesn't make any specific claims. It's so vague that you don't know what to make of it. If you read astrology, for example, if you read an astrology reading, your brain will try to find all kinds of underlying meaning, and that is what makes astrology psychologically appealing. And the way that these readings or these charts are constructed is to exploit these ambiguities because it has been shown. I mean, a successful astrologer knows, quote unquote, that it is a good way to convince a client. Just put out as many ambiguous statements as you can, and you'll see that something will stick and people will find their own meaning. That's not exactly the same way, but that's the thing that I tried to do with this abstract. So just put out something that is explicitly meaningless, and you'll see that even then people will swallow it because they as you said, they will see hidden layers of deeper meaning shimmering through the text, but they're not there. Well, for me, it was an interesting experiment because I thought it was too ridiculous to stand a chance at those conferences. But to my own surprise, I didn't have any problem at all to get them accepted.
And we'll link to this beautiful gem of a paper on on the podcast website so that our listeners can enjoy that shimmering almost meaning the same way I just have. We're just over time now for this part of the podcast, but hopefully you will have something almost as delightful to recommend to our listeners in the next segment, the Rationally Speaking Picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Martin Baudry, for his suggestion. Martin?
Well, one of the things that I read lately was Daniel Dennett's book, Intuition Pumps. I forgot the subtitle, actually, but you'll find it. It's in a way, it's an overview of his work. I mean, people who are deeply familiar with Dennett's work will not find much that is novel in his book. But I think it's refreshing to read that, you know, this kind of book, because he's a very interesting philosopher. I think he's one of my favorites, and he has become famous over the years for what he likes to call these intuition pumps. But they have been scattered through his works, and this is really a book that develops this idea of intuition pumps and tries to apply it to a whole range of different problems. So, what is an intuition pump? It is a way to get clear or to make explicit intuitions that we have. Moral intuitions, intuitions about knowledge, intuitions about reality, by means of thought experiments. So then it compares it to some sort of machine that you use to pump up your intuition. So you start out with a thought experiment, see what your intuitive answer is, and then you can try to modify it by turning on the knobs and the levers and see whether or not your intuition changes. And if you have a good intuition pump, it really allows you to get clearer about what your intuition was in the first place, what is underlying your intuition. Because the thing about intuitions is that they just pop into your head, and you don't really know what are coming from. So they're inchoate, as they say. So it's a very wide-ranging book. But it's highly accessible. His prose is very very lucid. I think it's original because of all the interesting illustrations and thought experiments. So for somebody who is for people who are not familiar yet with Dan's work, I think it's a great introduction. And even for professional philosophers, it's a great overview of his work, and it may be also a stepping stone for further reading, because it's full of references to other stuff that he wrote. So I think that it will be interesting for many listeners of this podcast who are interested in science, philosophy, and reasoning. I mean, Dennett is someone who is a staunch defender of science on the one hand, but on the other hand, he also thinks that there's much of value in philosophy. Contrary to what some scientists have suggested, you know, some scientists tend to be pretty dismissive of philosophy. They think that it's a waste of time. I think Dennett is a prime example that you can be a good philosopher and be well versed in science at the same time. And as I said, I mean, in the first half of this podcast, where exactly you want to draw the line is not really that important. It's just that these are stimulating ideas. These are stimulating thought experiments and illustrations to solve important questions about free will, morality, knowledge, about consciousness, all things that Dennett has written about.
Yeah, I've heard excellent things about intuition pumps as well. So we'll link to that also on the podcast website. Martin, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Martin. Yeah,
the pleasure was likewise. So.
And everyone can now download the Philosophy of Pseudoscience Kindle edition on Amazon, and I encourage you to do so.
I had no idea that it was released yet, so I have to.
Yep. It is. Everyone includes you, Martin.
Yeah, that's right.
Do we have to buy it?
You probably do.
All right. Well, this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.